Hello, everyone, and welcome to Make It Steamy, or whatever we made it sound kind of terribly more steampunk romance than necessarily steampunk, but we're going to go. This is our illustrious panel of pseudo-steampunk experts, experts in quotation marks. I am Anton Strau. I am proudly this year's author guest of honor. Rare when it happens, but I'll take it. I have a steampunk tale coming out in Westward Weird, which is kind of American paranormal anthology that Carrie Hughes, who's running around here and doing some of the panels, I've got that coming out with her, and I'm also in the midst of selling this mostly complete YA steampunk Dickensian street urchin Voltron Iron Man series.
You got all that?
Exactly. I qualify. It's a really weird little niche that no one else can then write in that niche. And then I become the master of that niche because nobody else wants to pigeonhole themselves that distinctly down here. And to your left is...
Hello, I'm Paul Jeunesse. I'm author, editor. I have a story in Steampunked, DAW anthology edited by Gene Raby and Martin Greenberg. Called The Nubian Queen. I love steampunk, as you can maybe tell. And I think it's a really great genre. I haven't read extensively in it. I haven't read like the entire, you know, volume of all the steampunk stories, but I've read a lot. I really like steampunk, so I'm very excited about this panel. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. I'm Lawrence C. Connolly, and I started off writing science fiction back in the early 80s, selling those early stories to Amazing Stories, before I switched over to horror and fantasy. But I'm getting back into science fiction, and particularly steampunk. I experimented a little bit in a new story based in the Sherlock Holmes universe, which is going to come out from Edge Science Fiction this fall. It's going to be in a collection called Gaslight Arcanum. And in this story, I incorporated elements of steampunk. And next year, I'm going to be, this fall, but coming out next year, I have a story titled Zeppelin to the Moon. And it's going to be in a collection of Professor Challenger stories, also from Edge Science Fiction.
That's cool.
My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University as my day job. I teach courses in fantasy and science fiction and creative writing as well. My first novel came out a couple of years ago. And I'm also co-hosting a podcast with Broad Bollier, who's also in the Writer Symposium, called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans. And we are going to be interviewing several steampunk authors, including a person who knows something about it, this man to my right. So we'll be interviewing him as well. I am staggeringly unexpert on all of it. I am on this panel to listen, to learn, and occasionally say, I agree with what has been said. So,
My name is Maurice Broadus. I'm a fantasy, horror, science fiction writer. I have an urban fantasy series that's out right now. You can get it at the Apex table down the author's alley. It's called The Knights of Breton Court, and it's the legend of King Arthur, except set in modern-day inner-city Indianapolis, because that's what I do. I'm probably the most accidental steampunk writer on this panel. I didn't even know anything about steampunk like a couple years ago. I just knew enough to make a joke on Twitter, which you're going to find this a theme in my life. Twitter is like the bane of my existence. So I made a joke on Twitter that said, I'm going to write a steampunk story with all black characters and call it Pimp My Airship. And like five editors wrote me to go, send me that story when it's done. So I'm like, oh crap, now I gotta write it. So I actually wrote and sold Pimp My Airship, and that's led to a series of, right now, short stories I've set in that same universe. Come in the Hot and Steamy anthology that Gene Raby also edited. I was working on a Jamaican steampunk short story.
Wait for it.
But before I got it done, an editor snatched it and said, hey, turn it into a novel, we want it. So probably the end of next year, there'll be a Jamaican steampunk short story from me also.
What's the genre?
All right, I've been calling it steampunk.
I love that. Can you just stop the panel now? This is awesome.
How do you top that.
That's why we brought Maurice. Maurice is not originally on the panel, but after talking in the bar there, and I'm like, oh no, you are coming towards me. I'm like, we need that.
Twitter and the bar. Like,
there we go.
Kind of that whole joke-making thing of, like, I'm going to do a steampunk story called Pimp My... Like, it really is kind of like mashing up, in almost a joking fashion sometimes, and you suddenly end up with, oh my crap, these things kind of marry well together, mm-hmm. and then you suddenly have an entire genre kind of born. For me, you know, the end-all be-all of steampunk, and really this is the only thing you could... Once I say this, you can just leave, because this is going to cover all of it. Steampunk is what happens when goth discovered the color brown. I kid. I was at Book Expo of America in New York, and the panel was Liz Gorinsky, who edits a lot of steampunk, and my friend Cherie Priest, who does kind of American zombie-oriented steampunk, and Cap Valenti is kind of a... She's colorful, I will say.
Yes.
And she very much was branding like, no, they had color back then. Why do so many writers in steampunk really just go with kind of the browns and dark hues and stuff like that? And, like, she's just, like, she's such... Like, because there has been created such a niche of what steampunk is, then now... The definition of steampunk is rapidly changing because everybody's now saying, like, yeah, that's great, and there are some precepts, but I want to really now take it in this direction, where you're getting a lot of American West type stuff kind of developing out of it. My question to you guys, and I'm not really going to over-define the genre right now in this conversation at all, but I'm curious, well, we know when you first kind of heard of it.
Right.
I'm curious about the rest of us here on the panel, when you first kind of really even noticed the word, or that there might be a genre out there?
I think I first noticed it a long time ago, long before there was a genre, and I'll tell you where. It was in the 60s. It was in a film called The Fabulous World of Jules Verne. It was a Czech film. And if any of you have seen it, I think it's a definitive work of steampunk. And it's partial animation, partial live action, and it has all of the tropes that we've come to expect in steampunk. Another work that I saw also in the 60s, now these are films because this is before we actually had this literary genre, steampunk, and these are the ones that kind of planted the seed in my mind. The other one was a film, Ray Harryhausen and Charles Schneer, based on H.G. Wells' First Men in the Moon, right? And so we have this great character actor, Lionel Jeffries, playing Cavour, and he has his mansion kind of gutted, and he has this huge blast furnace, huge coal furnace in the middle of his living room, and he's firing it up, and he's making Cavourite. And he has things that are very steampunky in the film that aren't in the novel. For example, the sphere that they use to take to the moon, it has railroad bumpers on it to cushion it when it lands. And it has these wonderful clattering blinds that go up and down and lower the Cavourite and raise the Cavourite. And so when I got the opportunity to start writing steampunk many, many years later, just about 6 months ago, when Charles Prepelik and Brian Hades from Calgary from Edge Science Fiction contacted me and said, would you be interested in writing a Professor Challenger story? I got this idea of Zeppelin to the Moon by thinking, what would happen if Cavour, not so much as written by H.G. Wells, but the Cavour as depicted by Lionel Jeffries in the film First Men in the Moon, were to get together and work out a way to take a Zeppelin to the moon. And I did think about this, and the science is going to work, folks. You could actually, take an airship to the moon. I've got to, I can't give away how to do it, but the story will be out next year. So that, for me, interestingly, it was cinema when I was young that planted the seeds that made me finally decide that this is a genre that I want to work in.
So, Greg, I'm assuming that about 12 minutes ago may have been the first time.
Well, after Paul was nice enough to give me a quick cram course, and with volume one of Steampunk. No, one of the things that's actually interesting, but even before I was furiously cramming for the panel, is that a lot of the stuff that I had read when I was a kid was much more closely connected to steampunk than I thought it was. I certainly wasn't aware of it at the time. And one of the examples was one, because I was thinking as I was reading through it, I'm like, this reminds me a lot of, and then as literally as I'm thinking in my head, I read Tom Swift. And I'm like, holy cow, Tom Swift was an early, really kind of semi leading us in the way of steampunk, and it actually was, both in terms of its adventurism, its kind of, you know, on the frontier kind of stuff that it was doing, and the way that it was kind of marrying technology, but in an older sort of way. So we're dealing with wonders, but it's a clearly dated sort of thing. And that's one of the fascinating things about steampunk, right, is that steampunk is all about technological wonder set at a particular time period. So it's not really technologically wondrous to us, but we are amazed by the wonder that the characters find in this technology that they have. And so I was astonished as I started looking at it and was going, and Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and people that I did used to read when I was younger, I'm like, maybe I did read a little bit of stuff that was like steampunk once, more than I thought I did. I thought that was fascinating. I read in preparation, I voted on the graphic novels category for the Hugos, because it's going to be at Worldcon in a couple of weeks, and I read Girl Genius as one of the graphic novels, and I'm reading through it, and I must admit, I hadn't known about Girl Genius before, so I read that, I was like, this is really cool. And I'm reading, you know, and I'm like, da-da-da-da-da, and then Girl Genius, I'm like, oh, awesome, another thing that was steampunky. And so I feel like in every one of these cases, either steampunk has incorporated a lot of things that I already knew about when I was younger, or it is that there have been so many connections. Steampunk has, in a lot of ways, drawn from a lot of things to produce everything we love about speculative fiction, wonder, awe, amazement, a different world, and yet familiar enough that we have access to that world, and yet it was able to do all of these things in a way that stood out above other kinds of subgenres that kind of came and went. And it feels to me like steampunk is much more likely to stay than some of those subgenres. So,
for me, I remember I was a huge William Gibson fan from the get-go in the early 80s, and I remember that they coined the term cyberpunk at the time. Which he kind of hated that term, I think.
And still does.
And just a quick sidetrack note, my day job is with Ace Rock Books, who also happens to publish me out of New York. It's terribly nepotistic, but I'm sitting in my office one day, and William Gibson walks by my door, and I was like, and then I went and had sandwiches with him, and it was like my 14-year-old self's brain just exploded. It was fascinating, but I had been a huge cyberpunk, and then he and Bruce Sterling did the Difference Engine, which really, for me, was the pivotal thing. Like, yes, we have that Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, like, clearly there is stuff that is cool and technological predating, but, like, as the term, and it then came up in some submission to Locus magazine online, which is a big spec fiction mag, and one of the submissions, the person had written in the letter and had coined this actual word steampunk after cyberpunk, but without technology in their submission, and that's like, thus a genre was born. And it's not, what fascinates me is like, it's a culture. It is a phenomenon, as the front row here attests, in their gears, hats, pulleys, and bustiers and such. Lovely décolletage, ladies.
Guest of honor.
Guest of honor.
But for me, like, I love, like, Neil Stephenson's Diamond Age, which has electronics in it, but there's something so absolutely Victorian in its sensibility that I really, and he writes in a certain style that I'm like, well, it does not fall into a rigid definition of steampunk, but I absolutely sit there and stylistically it feels so much in there that I'm like, I'm going to crib and put it in there. We'll take a question. Yes?
Well, I thought Diamond Age sounded really steampunky, but then I read recently on writing steampunk that said, gotta have monster. And what do you think?
That is not necessarily
no,
true.
No, you do not.
I know that.
For me, my attraction to the whole thing personally, and you guys can tell me your attractions to it or why you choose to dabble in it, or like, to me, I love the cool factor of things. I like to write cool things. And the idea of a world where electricity turned left instead of right, or development of technology went somewhere other than the way we are now. And kind of historically, like, I was a huge fan in D&D of Tinker Gnomes, because there were guidebooks where Tinker Gnomes created all this stuff during D&D days, and you look at it now and you're like, oh yeah, that's kind of steampunk with some magic thrown in and what have you.
Yep.
But I really do look back and I'm like, well, to me it's just kind of what happened to the world when it did not develop exactly the way we did with our technology.
So steampunk, you know, you can really consider it something like this. What if the future came earlier? What if there were certain advancements in science or magic, you know, in the 1800s, in the Victorian era? And that's the epitome of the genre in the past. That's H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. It's Jules Verne, which, and I think Lawrence was referring to Mysterious Island.
No, actually, I was referring to First Men on the Moon. Mysterious Island was a good one, where they had the balloon in it.
You mentioned something, the world of...
The Fabulous World of Jules Verne.
That's a movie.
Czech film, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And it has a submarine with fins on it, and it has these levers, and the fins are moving through the water, it's swimming through the water. It's a brilliant film. You've got to see it. It's black and white, it's animated, and it's animated so that it looks like the old... how did they used to reproduce photographs back in the 19th century?
On glass?
Actually, on metal, right? Metal etching.
Tintypes.
Yeah, tintypes, that's the word. So the whole thing is illustrated to look like tintypes. So you have real live people interacting with it, with tintype backgrounds, tintype foregrounds, and all the machines are kind of two-dimensional. They're cut out, but they're all moving. It's great stuff, and I think it is available now on DVD. Very well worth checking out.
Cool.
But Mysterious Island, the Ray Harryhausen film, is a good one. The balloon is in the beginning, and the submarine at the end. Those Captain Nemo sequences at the end, where he's playing the organ as the island is coming down around him, and they've got the shells on their back to breathe the air. That's also a great steampunk film. Proto steampunk.
For me, Mysterious Island, that's the name
we'll
of the
tell
film.
You in a minute.
That was like my first experience. I think I was watching like the Disney Channel as like a little kid, and I saw Mysterious Island. And it has Captain Nemo and the Nautilus and this volcano, and there's dinosaurs. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
There's pirates that attack the island. It had it all. It had crazy technology. It was really, really good. That was Nemo running around in a nuclear-powered submarine in the 1800s. That's steampunk right there. And I think it bears reading a quote, because steampunk came about when K.W. Jeter, who is one of the preeminent steampunk authors, wrote something in Locus. And this is, you can find this essay in Steampunk, edited by Anne and Jeff Vandermeer. I recommend that you get this book. It's really, really good. It has amazing steampunk stories in it, and it has, more importantly, several essays about steampunk that will give you the history. So here's the quote. This is... Rick Claw writing about it. Rick says, Mysterious Island was my first exposure to steampunk, long before K.W. Jeter coined the word late in the 1980s. This was in 1987 in Locus Magazine, issue 315. Personally, I think Victorian fantasies are going to be the next big thing, as long as we can come up with a fitting collective term for them, for what Tim Powers, James Blaylock, and myself have done. Something based on appropriate technology of the era, like steampunks, perhaps. So that was in 1987, and nobody was using that until he came up with that, and that was in 87. So it's like almost 13, 14 years later when the term really started to get big, and steampunk is not just literature, as most of you know. Most of people in America who are into steampunk are into the fashion.
Yeah.
Instead of just the goth kids, they're steampunk kids now. I didn't really know that, to be honest with you. Maybe some of you know that. Kids are going to school wearing steampunk outfits, and they're getting ostracized like the goth kids were.
Yes!
It's heartwarming.
Panic at the Disco has that awesome video where they are the League of Steam, even. And I'm like, it's in modern music videos. And it has such a cool
part.
Factor, and it is such a phenom, kind of above and beyond just, like, cool things and air. Like, the YA steampunk Dickensian Voltron street urchin thing I'm doing right now.
I love the Voltron part of that.
Yeah. Dickensian Voltron.
Voltron is the street urchin? I want to be clear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, no.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Or blazing pot. Like.
But in doing that, I find that like that's not the project that's under contract, and I'm having ass loads more fun writing that than I am writing the stuff that's under contract, because I'm totally taking what like is cool technology now, and I'm like, how would they do this with maybe coal, chemicals, and steam power? And it's like these teenage kids almost blowing themselves up half the time, which I'm sure parents will really rally behind. Science is bad, kids.
But I want to actually ask a question about that, because one of the things that I have started to notice that people have been talking about in this field is the idea that there's this big separation, right? This steampunk 2.0, or whatever the equivalent would be, 1893 version as opposed to 1878 or something. But this idea that steampunk is increasingly becoming about the cool and not about the sort of sub-revolutionary kind of politically disparate core that the initial steampunk was supposed to be about, right? Cyberpunk, steampunk, that all assumes fighting back against the establishment, undermining it, creating subcultures. And the assumption was, I mean, and it actually talks about it in steampunk in a couple of essays there, that people are sort of frustrated, like, this is what they're doing now, and it's just this, it's become this mainstream thing. And I wonder, from the actual experts on this panel, is that part of the typical, like, well, as soon as we actually started reading it in abundance and people bought it, it automatically becomes bad? Or is it which seems to happen a lot, or is there actually something to that we have focused so much on the cool factor that we've lost the kind of countercultural anti-establishment meme? And I don't know if that's true, I'm just asking.
All right, well, this is where I came in with steampunk, because like I said, I didn't know anything, so I ended up reading Steampunk Volume 1, Volume 2, and then Extraordinary Engines, which was another anthology of steampunk work. And as I was reading all these steampunk stories, I was like, yeah, I can't do any of this. a big part of it was, it's an ode to Victorian eras and mores and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? Black people didn't fare too well back then. So when I'm sitting down to write Pimp My Airship, for example, I was like, well, what would happen if I took, well, this bottle of Riesling that I'm going to consume, and then tweeted it, and then tweet while I'm writing, and listen to a bunch of Parliament Funkadelic CDs, and, you know, and then come at it from not really from a political situation, because, well, I was drinking, but to examine exactly that, you know, examining the power structure of, you know, what would a class structure look like in such an era, as well as advancing the technology. But then on the flip side, as I'm sitting down to do the Jamaican story, the most fun I'm having, apart from creating this universe, which starts with, hey, what if Jamaica was a superpower?
Awesome.
Yeah, man.
Awesome. It's just awesome.
Right. But the part of the fun, besides the whole alt history part of the world I'm building, is the fashion. Because I'm like, all right, now, what would black people wear if we ruled the world? So that's been a big part of the fun for me. You know, I'm watching Project Runway and calling it research, and just doing all these sketches and stuff, just figure out just the sheer costuming aspect of it, because that is such an important part of the steampunk world and the steampunk movement.
So I think that eventually we're just going to have the rally where there's going to be people being like, less steam, more punk.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I go, because I'm a very loose writer anyway, it takes me a while to get to my detailed research part where I go for my fun, cool aspects, because that's what interests me first. But as I'm delving deeper into it, the fashion, like I watch a lot of Runway and America's Next Top Model and all that other stuff. But still, Runway mostly, and like, just like the construction of stuff. And for those of you who are writing or dabbling in writing there, the thing I find interesting to me is that like the genre definition is broadening, and never be hindered too much by what you already think steampunk is. Mm-hmm. Because to me, I go to way too many forums where I see people being like, that's actually a gas lamp that you're talking about. I'm like, oh, fuck you, because I'm writing this book.
Guest of honor.
Guest of honor.
You can't leave. I have to. No, but like, what I'm saying is, like, look, and this happens all the time. The internet is a place where people piss on each other. And it's a place where you do something and someone calls you out and they don't like the way you do it. Well, that is why you wrote your book and not their book.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And steampunk, I feel like you see, it's a close culture and a very passionate culture, which has the costuming and LARPing and a lot of other stuff that kind of ties into it. And everyone always feels much entitlement and ownership to their culture. And then when other people come in or the definition changes a little, you've got the people who kind of resist and fight and whatever. And I'm like, if you were writers and you were doing steampunk, the only question you should be asking yourself is, like, what do I find cool? Like, what story isn't being told that if I need to change the world, and we all are changing the world, we are fantasy writers. When I watch people get hung up on something I do in my fantasy, like, oh, the vampire would die. I'm like, how do you know how a vampire would die? How do you know this? Please, enlighten me. And with steampunk, the details are so precious, and sometimes they're so historically based with a twist. And some people have this weird disconnect that I don't get, because as a creator, I don't want to be restrained too much or too hyper-focused in on, well, steampunk is a very narrow window. Mm-hmm. I'm like, my friend Cherie Priest got a lot of crap, but then became a pioneer and award winner for her Dreadnought series, and I forget the name of the other book. It's American Post-Civil War.
Bonechaker.
Bonechaker, that was the first one. And it's fantastic, and it got kind of like post-Civil War Americana zombie stuff there. And it's like, she did not want to write... Like, I'm kind of struggling a little with my Victorian England... My Victorian England right now is so much more diverse than it actually was. And I do not know how much time I should put into actually, like, do I get into this heavily? Is it just the fact that, you know, black people and Indian people are so much like, well, the professors and scientists are all like, I it's weird trying to set the multi-ethnic stage of it because it goes against it, but I'm like, well, since I'm already building a world of airships and whatever, it's like I've got to define what the true parameters are of it. I can give a general pastiche, but I don't really want to be that lazy a writer in the process.
Well, let me take that diversity thing a little bit. So I was at World Fantasy in 2009 in San Jose, and I went to the panel called Why Steampunk Now? And Maurice and I were talking about this. And sitting on the panels, Liz Gorinsky, the Tor.com steampunk editor, Michael Swanwick, who's written steampunk novels, I can't remember the other person.
Nisi Shaw.
Now, Nisi Shaw's sitting on the end, much like Maurice, and she's...
the black people portion of the panel?
Yeah, similarly, she has a similar skin color to him. And we're wondering why she's on the panel. She's like this amazing poet, she's won awards, and she's very literate, just really an amazing woman, all right? We're wondering why she's on the panel. So they do the introductions, and the moderator asks, so what do you guys think of steampunk? And Nisi Shaw says, forgive my accent, I hate steampunk! We're all like, holy shit, what just happened? And then she starts going off. There's no black people in it. If they're in it, they're slaves, they're servants, and she's going wild about this. And I came to this panel because I was asked to write a steampunk story, and I thought, okay, what am I going to do? And suddenly I'm like, okay, I have to write a steampunk story that only has black people in it. That's it. And because of that panel, and I believe another one that Nisi was on at WizCon that Maurice could comment on in a moment, it changed the steampunk movement right now. Because all these writers went, oh my God, there's no diversity. This sucks. It's all white people running around in London. So Nisi's working on a steampunk set in Africa. Maurice is doing his thing. There's other people working on this now. I wrote The Nubian Queen, which is in steampunk, you know, which is, you know, basically 1800s Africa, and Egypt is the center of the world because Cleopatra the Great and Mark Antony defeated Octavian and destroyed Rome, and then the little Ice Age wiped out Europe, and Alexandria became the new Rome. And now it's years later, and the black people are in charge because they married into the Nubian ruler. Anyway, alternate history, it's so cool. So I think right now we're seeing a change in steampunk, and Maurice is like leading the way over here with this.
Accidentally. Because I was at part two to the panel you were talking about, because then it was still Liz Gorinsky. It was at WizCon. It was Liz Gorinsky and Nisi. Theodore Goss was on this panel. Jamie Goh, who does a lot of Asian steampunk stuff. And they were talking about, you know, the lack of diversity in steampunk. And then Nisi's like, well, you know, there's a story by this guy named Maurice Broaddus. And I'm sitting there going, oh, Lord, I hate women. Hey, you know, what's going to happen to him? But the friend next to me is like, and he's sitting right here! He's sitting right here! Like, I'm like, oh,
yay.
And so... almost lost the point of what I was going to make. And so when I was writing Pimp My Airship, I mean, one of the things I wanted to do, because, like I said, the alt history part of it is the part that fascinates me the most. And so I began that whole story with, what if the American Revolutionary War never happened? And America was just another colony of England. And now what does that do to the whole race dynamic, the history of slavery, and all that kind of stuff, and then launch my story out of that. So I get to create almost my own little caste system and get to examine politics from that perspective.
I think what we're hearing here is that steampunk is growing up, but the genre is evolving. There's so much that we can look at out there. It's not only the 1800s in England. If you go back and you read your history, you'll see that a writer, an Arab writer named Al Jazeera, sounds like the news network, Al Jazeera, 2,000 years ago, was writing about the possibility of having steam-powered servants. And this is something I haven't seen exploited. I haven't seen anybody write about this. I think this would be a great thing to do. Take steampunk back 2,000 years and put it in Saudi Arabia and see what happens. Plato, actually Aristotle, wrote about or spoke about having machines that could do the things that people do. And he wrote about what if you could have a musical instrument that played itself. What if you could have a so some way of water being able to deliver itself, because that was a big thing back then, getting water delivered to where it needed to be. And so as we look beyond the borders, not only the physical borders of London in the 1800s, but we also look beyond the temporal borders of the time when London in England could have discovered the wonders of technology through the power of steam. I think we're going to discover in the next few years this opportunity to move throughout the world and throughout history and expand steampunk so that we end up evolving into another genre that it can still be called steampunk. It will still have those sensibilities and will still have that technology, but it's going to go global, I think.
I totally agree, and I'm seeing that happen in the day job with one of the big six in New York. We are seeing, like, with the success of certain authors out there in steampunk, and then seeing people who, like, Nightshade get some steampunk out there in their smaller literary press, and they win awards, then suddenly the rest of people in the publishing industry, it's like, everyone's always looking for the new trend, editor-wise. Like, people have been saying, oh, vampires are done. I'm like, no, vampires are selling more and better than ever. That is the trend that does not die. No real
comment.
But now zombies are way too many. So thanks to Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, which was a great one-shot, but now everybody's doing the literary mashup and zombie fiction. There's gems, but there's a big pile of crap to also be picking out of. Editors are so looking for the hot genres, and at our house, we don't. I mean, outside of we have William Gibson as an in-house author. He different sense of it. Yeah, as far as he was concerned. We are seeing, like, Devon Monk does more of a steampunk romance type series, and Marjorie Liu has one, I think, called The Iron Duke. Like, we're seeing steampunk now being blended out into all these other genres, and, like, a friend sent me Gail Carriger's Soulless series, The Parasol Protectorate, and she makes the argument that her books are not steampunk. Yet, when it becomes a marketing thing, it's like, well, they have parasols, and they dress in kind of Victorian garb and what have you. She doesn't consider them that, but now she does, because that's how they've been niched by a publishing company to get them out there to make sure that they sell. And it is a totally, it's trickling out every which way. And you know, if you're doing something unique, find out who the editors are on those projects. You can go to agentquery.com. You can look up so-and-so's agent. You can submit to them. It's easy to track these people down. If you're at conventions, you will run into editors who are like, oh, I dabble in this, and what I'm really looking for. Ask editors what they're looking for. And, you know, it's definitely, I've had a lot of steampunk inquiries just this con that I've been like, I don't normally get as many, and it may be because they saw I was moderating, but it's just fascinating that the way it is trickling out. Even in, like, regular, I had to explain to my wife, who doesn't really follow genre as much, why Richard Castle, for the Halloween episode, was at a party dressed as Mel Reynolds. And my mind had melted when I saw that. I'm like, this is so meta! And the steampunk episode and all that, I could not handle it. Yeah, it was in a mainstream thing, which we all got, and we're like, super awesome. But then to the norms, I could be like, oh, you should check out steampunk. And suddenly, like, I've not heard of this thing. And now they're adopting it, and sales are rising for that. So there definitely are markets that are growing.
I'm looking for steampunk in the Crimson Pact anthology series that I'm doing. It's demons, but there's many genres. Horror, there's steampunk, there's high fantasy, there's a lot of urban fantasy. And sitting in the front row is Sarah Hunts, who has a steampunk story in this, which is really, really good, set, you know, the World's Fair 1892. And it's really just a fascinating, really cool story. And then another steampunk story that I bought for volume one is this apocalyptic world with steampunk demon-possessed robots that are wiping out, you know, the population that's left on the planet. You know, just, I think steampunk is really cool and people want it. So for volume three, send me your flash steampunk stories. You know, and I'm definitely interested.
Well, I was just doing a reading last hour with Anton. Where Anton, he read that story for the Western Weird. And it was fascinating to me because he's reading this story that goes along and starts as a very traditional kind of, you know, Western, this gunslinger sitting in a bar, and then all of a sudden the gunslinger has a metallic arm with attachments and guns, and later on chain guns come in, and all of a sudden it's like, you know, BFGs and Doom revisited, and then of course airships, and all that stuff happens. And it as I was sort of listening to him describe it, I really was again seeing the kind of genre form in front of me, again and yet imagined in a different way, set in, you know, the equivalent of the American West, not Victorian England, but kind of going again in a different direction, and yet still clearly everyone was like, that's really awesome that you read that steampunk story. No one was confused about what it was, even though you said it's a mashup. Everyone was very clear it was steampunk, even though it had so many disparate elements.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I went with a lot of Wild West stereotypical tropes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just be like, well, it'd be cool if you had a hydraulic plate that kind of lifted that metal piece off your head to release your brains to draw the zombies in. That'd be cool if you'd build something like that. And I'm like, well, I'm doing that. That's going in there. But for me, the fun is that, like, I prefer to take stuff that we all kind of know from something else and then give it that flavor of, to me, I get really hung up on my gadgets, the how and the why of these things.
Yeah.
And I try not to put too much of it in the book. I think that's something the author should know. Like, you should know how your civilization, society, and all the gadgetry kind of rose up through that development of technology, because it is heavy that way. And that should probably never really end up too heavily on your page. That's
right.
World building.
Because you're not writing a source book.
Really see, right? No one wants to read the source book until much later on once you're a bestseller with
right.
it. But it, to me, it's like, I had to think of like, all right, where would this woman have gotten this gun arm? And she did a lot of self-forging, and it was a certain type of society where certain minerals and elements were being harvested in the American West at that time, in mining towns. And I'm like, all right, well, how would they then forge that? And all these little things that are in my mind that you never see on the page, other than it seems plausible that with your knowledge of the West and what was capable of that time, that with a little tweak and a little push,
yeah.
this seems believable,
yeah.
that they got here somehow.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part for me, is kind of like, what are those lines? Kind of drawing. We're at like 20 of, so like we have like 10 minutes. If there, I'm going to go to the question phase, unless you guys have anything pressing.
There's a t-shirt you may have to own that I saw in the dealer's room. It's Abe Lincoln, and he's got like a steampunk monocle on, and then he's got a chain gun on his arm, and then the text is, yeah, steampunk's kind of like that.
Yes?
Well, Cowboys and Aliens seems, I don't know if it's exactly steampunk, but it's Weird West for sure.
It's definitely Weird West. I put it more kind of in the science fiction-y thing from what I've seen of it, just because of the level of technology is an alien culture, technology off-planet, so I would throw it more in that kind of
But like steampunk, though, it's marrying nostalgia with future, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
And those combinations, I think, is what makes steampunk really work, and I think at least the particular kind of steampunk. And that, I think, is what makes Cowboys and Aliens work in a way. It's kind of nostalgia and future with an overlay of camp and Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford, but that, you know. So.
Have you ever thought of going to anime to kind of delve into your research?
There's anime steampunk, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, like I was thinking Trigon and, you know, almost everything that Hayao Miyazaki.
I love that the Stampede. I think that I spent way too much time watching them build all the cool things, carrying the big coffin down.
Well, and again, Girl Genius is drawing upon those tropes. I mean, that is kind of a steampunk anime and graphic novel form. It's drawing.
And I am a huge fan of Alan Moore's. The actual graphic novel of
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
We shall not say there was ever a movie made of that.
Although the sub was cool.
You know, to do an association here, you mentioned anime, and so I'm thinking animation. And has anybody seen the trailer for Leviathan?
Westerfield?
It uses that same look, if we're talking about the same trailer, same look that they had in the Fabulous World of Jules Verne. Things are looking two-dimensional, kind of limited animation. And it's black and white, right? Kind of silver, gray, and white.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yes?
Quick question. If you've read Carl Schroeder's Son of Suns or the other Virgo series, there's some steampunk elements in that as well, so we're familiar with those books.
What's his name again?
Carl Schroeder.
Carl Schroeder?
Yeah. I'm not. It's really interesting. It's a far future sci-fi steampunk, in a way. Basically, sort of transhumanism has taken over most of the solar system, with the exception of one artificial star in a sort of carbon nanotube bubble. But the star sort of repels their transhumanism, artificial nature, and so prevents the development of high technology. So everyone living within this sort of bubble of atmosphere has to distill what they made into alcohol to fire their engines that actually, they use as transportation, and it's sort of forwards and backwards at the same time. I really enjoy it.
One of the things I've really enjoyed about doing steampunk is that my regular series is contemporary urban fantasy type stuff, and what I have enjoyed the hell out of in my steampunk book is that there are no cell phones. And I don't really wish there to be any equivalent cell phones, because cell phones so screw up your narrative at times in modern stuff. And there's a great clip on YouTube of how cell phones fail in like every horror movie or wherever. Like, I've got no signal. Oh no, I dropped in the water. And it's like a 4-minute clip from like hundreds of movies. And steampunk has really been I like the fact that I have kept my steampunk anyway where communication's difficult. Like there's still no good way to kind of...
There's letters.
Yes, exactly. It's
they
like,
write them.
I will save you. I sent this letter a week ago and I sure hope I will be in time to save you. And like you, exactly, and I find that the kind of like, I like the hang-ups, like I can pick and choose how far my technology developed as best also serves the story, as it were, so that I do not have to worry about the fact that, well, why didn't they just pick up the phone and call in the actual cop to deal with that or something, and I'm like, no, they don't exist yet.
That's actually not really true. Exactly.
Guess what's not ending up in my book? this proves my rule earlier about how everybody, like historically and accuracy and stuff like that, really are like, you will tweak that reader out there. You're like, hold on a second. You know, they did actually have that then. And it's like, some people are going to, you're going to lose them there. But other people are going to hopefully kind of stay a little, go along for the ride, like.
Well,
as long as you're.
Steampunk is anachronisms. It's about anachronisms. That's what it is.
Yeah, so. And the benefit of fiber optic to get around that problem, you can't mobily carry a fiber optic cable with you as you fly in your airship. So
you can lay it as telegraph line.
You can just let it trail behind your airship for miles. And then it's like a big game of telephone as a kid. That's, you know.
You just have a giant wind-up wheel of cable behind you, tracks behind your horse.
That's nostalgia that the reader's like, it's gone too far.
Well, then drive yourself crazy over-analyzing all your technical or non-technical accuracies.
Yeah.
And then you will never get something written, I find. Like, you will hang yourself up on the details to the point where you produce nothing.
Well, I mean, that's why I did... Set my universe up the way I did because, you know, history is my weakest area. I ain't gonna lie. I'm writing alt history, so I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna have to learn real history in order to change it. That's just not gonna fly. So
how did history actually go?
Yeah. So that's why, you know, the conceit is because America lost the Revolutionary War didn't happen, well, I get to rewrite all the technology and all the history to prevent arguments like this.
Yeah, it's funny because my contemporary series, I go, that's kind of easy for me to write. If I say Empire State Building, done. We don't need to go into anything lengthy about that. But in trying to figure out what I am picking and choosing from existing history in a steampunk story, I got to do some work, man, and that's tough. It's tough in it's a different group of muscles. Mm-hmm. Like, because this I can concentrate fully on characterization and going lighter on detail, so it's almost more cinematic for me.
Yeah.
Whereas that, I feel like I then have to tweak maybe more literary, researchy muscle, and I enjoy it, but it's just an entirely different beast to kind of produce something along those lines.
It was so hard for me to actually write the Nubian Queen, which is very big alternate history. You know, Europe's not the dominant force, it's North Africa, but it was so much fun to tweak it. You know, the poor, freezing white people in France sell one of their greatest scientists. His name's Eiffel. And, you know, he builds a tower, you know, in Alexandria where the lighthouse was, you know. And so there's the Eiffel Tower in, you know, Alexandria. All those little tweaks, it's so much fun to play in alternate history, bringing the future earlier. I recommend, you know, to all of you to read a little bit in the genre and then have fun and explore. Just go with it.
I mean, and it's funny because I think as the writers of it, I find anyway that, like, I don't need to explain all of history. I just have to explain to you what's askew, a little to the left or a little to the right. And, you know, again, it's not suddenly we're writing the travelogue to, you know, the five-volume epic history of how the world really is now, but, like, through characterization, interactions with people. It's like, wait, he's talking to a black guy? That's weird. This world must be different at that time in Victorian London. And you just that little interaction tells you everything about the society, which the author has thought the hell out of to kind of be like, well, you're changing this shit.
But that's also why it's so easy to take, like, a steampunk short story and then turn it into a novel, because, like, all my short stories are now being turned into novels because, you know, you've spent so much time building this world. I mean, I know all the, you know, players in the world, all the different power struggles and all kind of stuff that's going on in the background already that I haven't put on the page.
Yeah.
So then I can't, well, now in a novel, have room to explore that more in greater detail.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're almost about out of time. I will give a quick round of pimping to everybody up here. I am always on sale and signing throughout the entire convention. As guest of honor, that is my purview. I'm always available to talk shop or writing or whatever if you see me out there. Paul, what do you got going on, and where can they find you?
Well, I'm going to be doing the part-time writer panel next, but in between, if you want to pick up a copy, I have two copies of Steampunked for $5 each. If you want to pick up the ebook, Volume 1, it has some steampunk stories, some steampunk westerns. It has some excellent little stories in that. And you can probably find me in the dealer's room around 3:30 or 4 if you want to talk more. So, yeah.
I'm going to be reading at 5 o'clock. I hope some of you are able to come around. I got some surprises for you. I also have a table. I don't have a table, but my publisher has a table downstairs, Fantasist Enterprises, in Author's Alley, and I'm going to hang out there a little bit between now and my 4 o'clock panel, so if there's anything else you'd like to talk about steampunk or you just want to come out and down and hang out, I'll be down there.
Don't forget your goggles either, like I did almost. Yeah.
I'm on a panel with Paul next, and I will be actually down in Author's Avenue signing at 3, so if people want to come down at that point and talk to me about other things that don't involve steampunk that I might know something more about, I will be there for that. So that's me.
I'll be doing a signing in 10 minutes. So
so just all follow them.
Yeah, everybody just come on down. Buy my books. And then I'm also in Author's Alley. I was recently made vice president of Apex Books.
I know that.
So because they can't afford to pay me, because they give me a title instead.
Okay. Why isn't this in a drunken tweet? Right. Come on.
You're the new VP.
Right.
Sorry, you're not getting paid.
Right. But I'll be down to Author's Alley in 10 minutes. So, and that happens to be right across from Apex.
You were so close to finishing well.
I know. So
all right, well, guys, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, guys.
All right,
tickets. Please, tickets if you haven't brought them up.